Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Well, many thanks to Amity Slays, who's agreed to do this Zoom discussion with us. It's 10 p.m. in the east of the United States, so we're very grateful. I'll introduce her briefly. Amity Slays is the author of a number of well-known books, but I think the ones in Australia we probably know the best are The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression, the book on President Coolidge, and now, and there's also a graphic edition of The Forgotten Man, but and now Great Society, A New History, which is just recently published by Harper, which is part of HarperCollins and is available. And Anne Henderson reviewed that in the Sydney Institute Review online only a couple of weeks ago. And so we'll come to a discussion with our guest today, and then I'll ask a few questions, Anne will ask a few questions, and then we'll call people in. The instructions about how you get in are in on the email which you received. And if you're absolutely desperate, you can always wave to us and someone will pick you up. I've got Nick here helping out, and Anne's in the other room. And so we lead off. Once again, Amity, many thanks for doing this. I should also say that George, chair of the Kelvin Coolidge Presidential Foundation. I should also say that as well, and many thanks to the people who are helping out on this today from there, including William. So off we go. I was very impressed when I read your book on Roosevelt and the New Deal, and now your book on the Great Society. And now, I guess, under President Biden, we're looking at a reset. So we're looking at three substantial developments in the United States from the 30s and now into the 21st century. So tell us a bit about what you wrote about Roosevelt and the New Deal, and then leading into what you're writing about in the 1960s, starting with Kennedy, but focusing on LBJ Johnson, President Johnson. Just give us a bit of a background before we start off.
Oh, of course. I just want to thank you in this group, which I first encountered and Gerard at a Mount Pelerin Society meeting now a long time ago when I visited you. So thank you for your interest in these questions. The first real history book I wrote was a book about the 1930s called Forgotten Man. And that came out of, can you hear me? Everyone hear me all right? Yeah, that came out of my work on the Wall Street Journal and a bit of curiosity about this period, which is sort of the Rosetta Stone for American economics, at least. It explains everything else and also all other behavior. And I was quite surprised to find that our textbooks didn't really tell the story very well. Particularly, they omitted the role of the private sector in the 1930s. They overemphasized the monetary. The monetary was quite divisive. You know, the monetarists fought with the Austrians, and they neglected the cost of labor. They neglected the cost of economic uncertainty. They neglected what we would call public choice theory. They neglected the role of the church. So our histories just didn't convey what actually happened. The Forgotten Man is a construct put out by sort of a relative of, I guess, of Spencer in the UK, intellectually named Sumner. And Sumner said, he had a little algebra. He said, A wants to help X, the man at the top wants to help X, the man at the bottom. Think of a sort of Victorian algebra as in the Mikado or something. A, two, A wants to help X. All right, A wants to help X, B wants to help X. We all want to help X, that's charity. But there may occur a problem if A and B get together and pass a law that coerces C, some third party into funding their perhaps good, but perhaps dubious project for X. C was the forgotten man in Sumner's story. And in the 1930s, the New Deal, Roosevelt, of course, focused on X, the man at the bottom of the economic pyramid, as he put it, but he ignored C. And they all knew this, and they debated it all the time. You have the wrong forgotten man. How can you, President Roosevelt, refer just to X and not to C, who funds it and endures it and perhaps loses the job for a long stretch due to that? So that's why the book was called Forgotten Man, because it was about whether a progressive undertaking is worth all the damage it does to other parties, including this mystical C, basically the taxpayer, whom Sumner called the man who pays, the man who prays, the man who is not thought of. And the bottom line on the Great Depression was we had unemployment over 10% in the United States for a decade. You can't write that all off to international or monetary. You can write some of it off to that, but not all of it. A lot of it was perverse labor policy and that uncertainty. So that's what that book was about. Because that was our big progressive foray, the next one was in the 60s. That was Our Great Society, and that's the newer book. You want me to keep talking? Or do
as
you
I recall, no, that's fine. As I recall, when I read The Forgotten Man, you start off your story with a wealthy business figure jumping off a building, and we're all expecting this is Wall Street collapse, but as I recall, it's not the 1938. So what you're saying in that book, and I wasn't aware so much of that at the time, is that just before the beginning of the Second World War, the US under Roosevelt had a second depression, which wasn't that much less severe than the original depression. So we're not so aware of this in Australia because we didn't have
a
depression.
Well, all right, so some things to know about this period, let's say 1920 to 1940, because I also wrote a book about the 20s, which is a biography of a US president in that period, but it was quite economic. The first thing to know was that we had a depression in the United States in the early 20s. It's called the Forgotten Depression. And my friend James Grant's Interest Rate Observer, wrote that book. And that depression, the policy recipe was to double the interest rate and to cut the government. Those were the policy prescriptions, and they worked. That is, the depression was very short. It was terrible. There was unemployment well over 10%, but it was so short that we don't recall it. That's why it's called the Forgotten Depression. The depression, actually, that F. Scott Fitzgerald was describing in Great Gatsby. So if anyone ever tells you about Great Gatsby in 1929, they're misleading you, or more importantly, they haven't thought it through, because the Great Gatsby, F. Scott Fitzgerald, this book about a market crash, which is all most secondary school students here now get about the market crash of the 20s, was published in 1925. It was not published with the market crash of 1929. Fitzgerald was actually describing the downturn of the early 20s, which was again doctored with a 300 basis point interest rate increase and a cutting of government. Very counterintuitive measures for today's economists usually. And that doctoring worked very well. Then there was another crash in 29. That was the famous crash, 4 years after The Great Gatsby was published. And after a very successful decade of genuine growth, don't believe Rothbard entirely. It was a wonderful decade, the 20s. We had enormous productivity gains. People got Saturdays off and electricity in the home, as well as an automobile. Civil unrest declined, lynching declined, people had interesting jobs and so on. Then came the Great Depression, and Friedman et al. Focus on the first part, the international part, and you study agriculture, and Kruger, the Match King, and the Kreditanstalt in Österreich, in Austria, and so on. But the neglected part of the Great Depression, and indeed what made it so great for the United States, was we did have unemployment over 10%, really 15. They fight about how you reckon it, but really 15 the entire decade. And in the second part of the book, as Gerard points out, I covered that, but I sort of foreshadowed it at the beginning because people were jumping out of windows and very sad and hanging themselves in 37, which is, well, almost 4 years after more than 4 years after Roosevelt was elected, because he was first elected in 32 and came to office in 33. So that depression is also forgotten. That's called the depression within the depression of the later 30s. You have a forgotten depression you never knew about in the early 20s, and you have the depression after the great crash of 29, and you have the depression of the 30s, and then you have the depression within the depression. And we have lots of debates about what made the recovery such as it was stall in the later 30s. The three factors I identify are labor cost, uncertainty, and also, you know, you can argue about this, but the government spent quite a bit and then pulled money out of the economy. For example, through Social Security, our pension program, people had to begin to pay into that. And we had a doubling of reserve requirements at banks, which was part of the New Deal too. And so it's all a contradictory interventionist, excuse me, mishmash. It's terrible. Roosevelt began to give up. And then he got distracted by international and arena in which he was had the better skill set for anyway. He was a good Navy president. He knew every crack and cranny of the US East Coast. He was a fine sailor, Franklin Roosevelt. He could sail dangerous waters. And he liked international and military, and he was felt at home in it. So he turned away from the New Deal without acknowledging its failure and went on to World War II.
So we had the United States come into the Second World War, late 41, early 42, the period of the 40s, is recovery on the domestic front under President Eisenhower in the 50s. It's a pretty prosperous time. So what brought about the need for the Great Society?
Right, and let me just pause and say, so often international and also domestic will ask me, but Amity, didn't the war spending end the war? And it's true, if you look to a chart of government spending, you'll see it explode in World War II. But I think the evidence suggests that the salient question is not how did the war end the Depression? Of course, an infusion always does something for an economy. It's why did the Great Depression of the United States go all the way to World War II? Why did we need to have a 10-year depression in the US? That's always the real question. But so Great Society is a very different event, much more like today, because we were prosperous. So you start with prosperity and incredible idealism of youth who are somehow separated from the preceding generation. We have the digital divide, they have their digital divide. And the youth in the United States, as you all probably know as well as I, were quite idealistic in the early 60s. And Johnson in particular wanted to answer youth. He saw Kennedy's predecessor had done that. He wanted to answer youth, and he wanted to go the Kennedy's one better. As you all doubtless know, Johnson was a fine legislator, master of the Senate, so he tried very hard to play to his skill set, which is getting laws through. He declared our goal is great society. He didn't say good society. The great notion, it gives you an example of his ambition, and he wrote a lot of laws and ran them through. it was said of Lyndon Johnson that he made laws the way other men eat chocolate chip cookies. That is fast and a lot. And he didn't really think of the result. He just thought of getting the law through. To him, the quantification of success, the metric was to the law, not result of the law. So that gets at the metrics. And he had a number of goals, including curing poverty. We didn't cure poverty. He promised to improve race relations through the Great Society. Apparently, we didn't do that in the United States. He promised to improve reading scores and math scores. We didn't do that. So the Great Society was a failure. And I think that's why President Biden refers to Franklin Roosevelt, President Johnson, even though his programs, Biden's, resemble those of Johnson more than those of Roosevelt. Recall, Roosevelt was operating in an economic disaster. Johnson was operating in a fairly good economy, at least at the start. That's what Biden's in, more or less. An economy, and Johnson and Biden both say, assume economic growth. So they start in opposition, assume growth, then assume growth, what can we do? But the question is whether it's accurate to assume strong growth.
So we're going to end in a minute, but to summarize on the Great Society, was there anything great at all about the Great Society?
Well, it was really a contest between public and private. Everyone aspires to great, right? And one thing great about the Great Society were the private companies. In this book, I follow the men who founded the company that became the chip maker, Intel. And they did revolutionize our life. They gave us the personal device. They gave us a lot of freedom. They took us away from the military industrial complex. Remember, in the early 60s, men who engineers who were ambitious, even Homer, the man in October Sky, the man who, you know, man, Rocket Boy, thought they had to work for the government because that's the only area you could work in serious electronics. In the 60s, that changed. So those men did much that was charitable. They became the greatest employer, and I have that in this book of Native Americans, with a chip factory in Shiprock, New Mexico, on a reservation. That is, the private sector can do a lot of things the government thinks only the government can do. And one is help Native Americans, and that would be relevant to you. So all that was going on. I'll say a little more about the Great Society. I think the error we made was affirmative action or pandering to groups. That's a legacy that of the United States right now, but very much unexpected. But I liked the private sector. I liked some of the government programs. I liked all the people, as wrong as they were, because they were trying. That's human nature. I like people, but it's important to point out their errors. I very much liked Walter Reuther, the head of the United Auto Workers, who was a tragic hero who practically murdered Detroit personally by pushing up the labor price with the collusion of Henry Ford so that our autos were no longer competitive. But I liked him, so I liked the people. They some of them took wrong turns they didn't have to. In the 50s, Walter Reuther, our big union leader at the UAW, was for profit sharing, but he got no support in that. I think it would have been better if the unions had been for profit sharing and home ownership instead of false socialism, which is what we got, kind of a stupid class warfare theater, because the United States really isn't a class country, but we made it a European style class country because that, I don't know, that felt fun, very destructive to our economy and to the prospects of younger workers. Does that make sense? Or are you bored? Is everyone bored?
Yep, it does.
You ask questions.
Yeah, I'm calling.
Hi, Amity.
Hi, there's Anne.
Hi, Amity. It's Anne. Hi. Hi. I loved your book.
Thank you. Thank you for the review.
It is very much like The Forgotten Man in that you spend a lot of time giving us the story of so many different groups. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
There's and a delay, but I can hear you.
Yes. And you move between the big institutions of unions, government, corporations, all these different fabric parts of the fabric of society, and yet you personalize it as well, so that it's like you can access the story. Now, I'm fascinated with the way you start, and the word great from an Australian's point of view. Americans are obsessed with this word great. An Australian MP the other day, I was doing his transcript for something he'd done for us, and he spoke about America being the Rome of the modern day world. So we take note of what happens there, and you love the word great. Even Donald Trump loved the word great. But this whole experiment starts with an intellectual in your book called Michael Harrington. And what's interesting about intellectuals is that they don't actually run anything. They think up great thoughts. And there's the word great again. And this Michael Harrington, with a bestseller book, comes into the Washington narrative, and he's got a wonderful plan for creating a great new world. This is the newness. I sometimes wonder whether we get these things from America because you created the society so you can recreate the society. So tell us about how the intellectuals, which later on with SDS and all this student activity, get connected with the unions, how this then pans out into a great failure in the end, but for
it was
the time,
a great failure. Well, yeah, I recently had a piece, probably you saw it, where I said, beware of great. The Trump people didn't like that. So it's right now in American radio, if you say something that might be hostile to Trump, then you don't get to go on conservative radio. It's amazing sometimes. But they didn't like that. But I do think that's because there's one, great is dangerous. And two, there's slippage. It goes pretty quickly and from great idea to great moi, right? Great me. Very fast. And that's what happened with Roosevelt. The election is about me, sort of like a French king. And that's what happened with President Trump, I think. I mean, it certainly happened with Johnson. It's about me being great. So it's a very dangerous word. And Coolidge said it's a, I'm paraphrasing, but that it's a great importance that the US president know he is not a great man. And it's a great safety for the country, for the president to know he is not a great man. And I like Calvin Coolidge very much for that kind of modesty. He understood that the president presides, he doesn't rule. He was very close to the framers. I mentioned him before, but that's why I work at Coolidge and I love Coolidge. Just to say something or other about the intellectuals, Michael Harrington was a socialist, very familiar type, very bright, went to Jesuit secondary school in St. Louis. So he's in my book. There are quite a number of Catholics in my book. And he was more on the social end of it. And he happened over to the White House and got involved in writing our Great Society poverty law. Now, he was to the left of the Johnson administration, so he didn't get very far. He encountered Sergeant Shriver, another idealist, and he told Shriver that $1 billion wasn't very much to be spending. That was the notional idea on the bill. They were going to spend $1 billion to eradicate poverty. And Sergeant Shriver, who had more experience in real life than Michael Harrington, who was just a goofball, who gave speeches, said, a good writer and a passionate man, but a goofball. Sergeant Shriver said in one of his better moments, I don't know about you, young man, but it's not every day someone gives me $1 billion to spend, and I take this seriously. That would be trillion now, right? But this was 1964. So they got together this was called Economic Opportunity Law, and they created all sorts of crazy offices with just horrible principles. They were kind of going to teach towns how to give people the franchise. So what they ended up doing was funding opponents to mayors in towns. So the mayor might be a traditional Democratic Party member, and they'd be funding the hard left guy. The federal government would be funding someone to campaign against a mayor in a town, which goes against our constitution, actually. And they got up all sorts of mischief because of idealism.
So we got people in on the call. If you want to come in and make a comment or ask a question, just send a sign to us. We've gone through the key presidents of the period, or the presidents of the period, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon. We've looked at the union movement. We've looked at the student movement. Now, what about Martin Luther King? So as the most biggest name, or one of the top four names of the United States in the period of the 60s, although he dies in 68, what were African-Americans, or then called Black Americans, how were they faring through, before and during the Great Society?
Well, if you want to analyze the Great Society, where I came out was the first part was good. That was the equal opportunity part. 8 out of 10 Blacks in Mississippi did not vote. Something must change. Why are they not voting? It's late as the 1960s. All right. We had a couple of important laws there. The Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, which actually came after. That's sort of to nail home the point. All right. Martin Luther King is a wonderful hero and very likable in this period. Important. I think Martin Luther King went wrong, just as the Great Society went wrong. And the Great Society went wrong. You can find the moment, which is a speech Johnson gave at Howard University, a historically Black university, right here in Washington, where I am now. And he said, equality of opportunity does not suffice. We want more than that. Basically, equality of, we want support all the way through. He said, you can't take a man who's been in shackles and put him at a race line and shoot the guns down at winning. That's a very compelling argument. But what he begins to say is we want equality of result too. We won't be happy with equality of opportunity. So we move beyond the education and the unshackling to spending on equality of outcome. And MLK, where was he in that period? A little bit lost. MLK was real in the South, less real in the North. I'm from Chicago, where he went in an effort to become a national leader to worry about housing of African-Americans in Chicago, which was terrible. But he never really knew what he was doing. And he was very much led by the unions again, over and over again, surprised by the role of unions in this. It was actually when MLK was in the Birmingham jail, who do you think bailed him out? The United Auto Workers sent the money. I never knew that. I would think, who would it be? Would it be Robert Kennedy? Would it be a nice philanthropist? Would it be the African Americans? No, it was the United Auto Workers. And the UAW taught MLK, who was a very wise man, but not particularly economic, to make class warfare. And that's what he did in the last couple of years of his life. For example, in Chicago, leading rent strikes. And even he felt this was wrong. You can observe it in his discomfiture at being a rent striker instead of a civil rights striker. He sort of came around to the idea that homeownership was more important, which is accurate, than rent strikes in terms of outcomes and what's important for African Americans. Property rights really matter more. So, you can see MLK all the way through this. He was murdered fairly early. It was terrible, the same year as Robert Kennedy. The most one can say of him is that he was very important, very wise, and probably wrong on economics towards the end. The real tragedy of the period is that we taught America that minorities are permanent lobbies, that we, you know, and that those lobbies must be ever more supported. And I'm not the only one who's written this, of course. I really recommend John Cogan's book, high cost of good intentions. He's a professor at Stanford at the business school and at Hoover. And the high cost of good intentions basically says we enshackled African Americans far more than we ever imagined through our 60s and 70s laws. By training Americans to think that people must always be on entitlements, on payments. And when I talk to secondary schools, you know, America's quite left right now. So I said something about food stamps to a bunch of secondary school students in Arizona, and a girl got up and said, "You're shaming me, and I am on food stamps." I said, "Well, not at all. All of us can come to want, and maybe it's good we have food stamps sometimes in the United States. But we can all there's more consensus, young lady, than you think, because I think you don't disagree that it's all right for a person to come to want and get food stamps or payments. And it's no shame, and there's no shaming, but it is a shame if we expect not only ourselves, but also our children and our grandchildren to be on food stamps, and that's the only way. Very few grandmothers want their grandchildren to be on food stamps of whatever ethnicity, right? Very few. They want something better. So that's where we left it. And that comes out of the 60s. What if we, did a counterfactual and said, had we in the United States taken the $20 trillion we've spent on this great society business, it to be sure that every African-American knew trigonometry, and every Hispanic and every Caucasian, everyone knew trigonometry, how many times you must take it. Because most of us can do trigonometry, we just need to do it several times, right? Most of us can get a fairly good secondary education. Some of us do it more slowly than others. I'm one of them with physics in particular. What if we had spent it on that instead of on social equity? Wouldn't we be better off? Because in the United States, the real problem is the workers aren't qualified for the jobs that are available. That is the problem. No, and so that's the great misstep of a great society. We didn't focus seriously on economic and educational outcomes the way we might have done if we'd spent 1/20th of that trillion and made it the goal of every 8th grader, every 13-year-old or 15-year-old to actually be able to read well and to do trigonometry. They would be more easily employable, and they would be able to rise at work. We wouldn't have this sort of false class warfare.
Thanks. I've got a question here for your assessment, your thoughts on President Johnson's personality in the context of the books by Barr McClellan and more recently, Robert Caro.
Those are wonderful books. Johnson's a lot of fun. He uses dirty words. He scared Sergeant Shriver to death. You could spend months listening to Johnson. They're all on YouTube now. But I tried to stay away from Johnson. I think one of the problems with presidential scholarship in the United States as a genre is that it focuses on men or women, but mostly men, and not the institutions. Our problem was that we had bad policy, and Johnson was a rather efficient implementer of bad policy. As I mentioned, he passed a lot of laws. If you look at the end papers of Johnson's memoir, he's so proud, all the laws are written, and most of them are terrible laws. But it was the laws themselves and not Johnson that's the problem. So our presidentism is a little boring. In domestic policy, a US president is not commander in chief. He has to work with Congress. So you want to look at what is the political impulse he's trying to get ahead of. Those books are good, but they make the presidents too important. And that's my problem with the genre. And I've written it because I wrote a presidential biography. It's not my favorite genre because you end up writing too much about what the fellow ate for breakfast and how wonderful and interesting it was and what affair he had and so on, and too little about the effect of the marginal tax rate or monetary policy or a certain social policy that destroys a region.
So from what you've said about institutions today, or tonight, your time, you seem to be saying that the United Automobile Workers was the most important institution in the United States in the 60s. I mean, that's probably an exaggeration, but what were the key driving institutions? I mean, there was Congress, obviously, but outside of Congress.
There was Congress, there was the UAW, there was the US Army. American men were different when we had the draft, no question. So people had been in the Army, Korea, World War II, or even, you know, in the Army when we, you know, we had the draft and were in the Army, and we went up to, I believe it was 500,000 men, you may know better than I there, in Southeast Asia, very fast, from 50 to 100. That was an important institution. With this week, I'm chairman of the Hayek Book Prize in the United States. And this year we're honoring Tom Sowell, whom you've read, the African-American economist. He'd be angry at me for saying African-American. Anyway, the reason I mentioned that is he said the US Army was the least racist institution he'd ever encountered. That was because he was interested in skills, and they tested him about like a good skill to have for him before he became an economist. And he had a good time, horrible moments, the way the military is. Good time on balance. The United States not prepared him professional. And a professional economist. So there was that institution. I don't think the unions were that important. I'll just say they were so much more important than contemporary Americans would have been, or I would have imagined, even though I've been asked, that was a big surprise for me. It would be less surprising to you, and it would be less surprising for a UK person or not. Out of our tougher union laws, you know about that, right? And that's where the jobs back. You'll find a chart, right, where states got more jobs faster. Union laws are just less tough. You don't have to be in a union, even if this company is unionized. Anyway, that right to work business, that didn't used to exist. Everybody in the union under our 30s law called the Wagner Act, but we created this loophole for states in Taft-Hartley subsequent to World War II. And one of the things, loopholes, so that in every state, everyone had to join a union. But it was back days under the Wagner Act, before the emasculating Taft-Hartley. And Johnson, the president, promised he would repeal right to work, old, strict, all-America union rule. And as it happened, in part due to Vietnam, Johnson never got to it. Never marshaled the votes. He had some surprise defections, including Everett Dirksen of Illinois, who was with him on civil rights, but against him on this. Because really, the old union way was compulsory unionization, and Dirksen understood that. And he was from the land of Lincoln. So anyway, as it happens, we kept right to work and it expanded. And that is the most important now in the United States. And look at the data now and look back. Half a century of data suggests unions are counterproductive often, and for workers as well. And what if that hadn't happened? And Taft-Hartley and repealed and all America and the evolution, we would have had less growth. And that's relevant because now, of course, the Biden administration would like to repeal right to work and go back to all union America. This is less surprising to you than to us. We're fools. You have more international perspective.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.